You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, the presidents of Taiwan and China are to meet on Saturday for the first time since the end of the Chinese Civil War, almost 70 years ago. My guests, Kathleen Burke and James Boyes, will discuss this and the other main stories of the day, including the European Union calls for a global response to the migration crisis and will first ask for action from the G20 countries. In the US, the Republican presidential candidates want more control over the television debates, and they can't even agree if they agree. And Jeb Bush apologises to the French for comparing the work of Congress to a typical French work week. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Kathleen Burke, who's Professor of Modern Contemporary History at University College London, and James Boyes, political historian and the author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy and the forthcoming book Hillary Rising. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start today in Europe. The European Union is calling for a global response to the migration crisis. The chairman of the EU leaders, Donald Tusk, and the head of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, made it clear today that they want leaders of the world's biggest 20 economies to help tackle the crisis that has no end in sight. In other news, Greece carried out today the first relocation of refugees as part of the EU-approved plan to ease the burden on border nations. 30 people from Syria and Iraq boarded an airplane in Athens Airport, bound for Luxembourg, where they'll start a new life. This is the first very tiny step in a €780 million scheme funded by the European Union. Kathleen, a kind of pitiful action, really, when if you're trying to relocate, 100,000 people in the next few months. We just haven't seen much movement on this at all. Do you think the call for the G20 to get involved hints that actually there's such a stalemate in Europe that they're looking for someone else to kind of pass the buck to?
It does hint at desperation. In fact, I think it's more than a hint. It's a bit sad because Europe itself is a rich area. And Australia or Canada or even the United States are going to wonder why they are being asked to contribute to difficulties in Europe. Now, it's quite obvious that for the United States, if Europe can't cope with this, there's going to be real difficulties in Europe in terms of political instability and an inability to concern themselves with foreign policy issues that the United States itself might think is really important. But China's not going to help. Well, as I come around in a circle, it's desperation. And I think there will be some help, but I think it's probably going to be help more for the look of help than for really substantial aid.
James, when you look at the G20 countries, there are some countries there who could potentially take a few people into their rather large countries. But as Kathleen says, they're not in the European arena. But does that mean they should be excused duty? Because in a way, I guess the UK is using that excuse, saying, we've got a bit of water between us and mainland Europe. Don't come knocking on our door because, they're not actually on our soil. In a way, that's what, some of these G20 countries are saying. If they get here, we'll deal with it. But they can't get here, so we don't have to deal with it.
I was thinking about your question when you were posing it initially, and the first thing that came to mind actually was a series of events that took place in the early 90s with regard to the breakup of Yugoslavia. At that point, the European Union was just coming together, and a series of leaders were claiming this to be the hour of Europe. The rest of the world need not get involved. We can deal with this ourselves. And within a very short time period, those leaders were found to be wanting, and it was not until the United States got involved that anything actually managed to transpire and sort that out at the Dayton Peace Conference led by Richard Holbrooke. But I think that what you're seeing now is very similar, a complete impotency on the part of Europe and European leaders to know how to deal with this. Clearly, there are issues which have generated this, which have transpired outside of Europe and triggered this influx into the European continent. But I think one of the challenges is, if you were to ask these desperate individuals who are fleeing to Europe. You know, do you want to be moved to China or to Australia? I think they would be quite hesitant to do so. They certainly don't necessarily want to be in the likes of Syria necessarily, but I think they would like to be within a proximity so that if there is a solution there, economically, politically, that they can return to the homeland, and that they don't actually want to be moved necessarily beyond the realm of Europe. And what you're seeing, I think, is a desperate knee-jerk reaction by the European leadership, who realise that the sort of nations like Greece, for example, Italy, are ill-disposed or ill-prepared to deal with this. And as a result, they're looking, as I think Kathleen used the expression, to kick this can outside of that area to try to bring in the wealthier nations like the United States, who, it must be pointed out, have already agreed to take on and take in some of these immigrants. But the sort of numbers we're talking about, as I think your expression was pitiful, would be more than appropriate, I think.
I guess what's also interesting, Kathleen, is when you look at some of these countries, you know, traditionally, Syrians have been people who have migrated around the world. I did a story some years ago in Brazil when they were saying that there may be up to 2 million people in Brazil who claim some Syrian heritage. So there's a large community of Syrians there. But Brazil's taken, I think, like 1,500 people so far. Brazil, vast country. I know it has some economic pressures at the moment, but it has the infrastructure of, you know, people who are from the Arab community and speak the language and understand what life is like in Syria. Canada, vast country, still huge parts of it, you know, underpopulated. Surely it isn't too wrong to say, actually, all of us need to kind of roll up our sleeves and look at how we disperse these people, because 160,000 people have been, you know, said that they will be, you know, relocated. But we now think that the numbers in Europe could be, you know, 800,000, 900,000, a million. Is it wrong, really, to go and knock on those doors and say, actually, some of you really do need to kind of think about this?
Well, there's two points there. First of all, I take your point about early immigrants, but it should be pointed out that that was voluntary and they went where they wanted to go. What sounds is these poor migrants or asylum seekers or whatever are going to be told, right, you're in box C, so you go to Brazil, you're in box D, so you go to Australia. In that sense, I take the point made that a lot of the Syrians, judging from the interviews that have been given, don't want to go away. They want to be there if they can go back. They want to be in Syria. But the United States had well over 30 million immigrants over the last generation. It's not so there is one argument that, yes, there's Idaho and there's pretty empty Wyoming and so forth. But on the other hand, the U.S. is becoming, in a funny sort of way, a xenophobic as everyone else is. And I think Europe, whoever Europe is going to have difficulty in shifting some of these hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, Norway's got nothing in the top three quarters of it, for example. There are places they could go in Europe. But the difficulty is those places that, if you think about it, some of the places like Sweden and like Norway and even like Germany are those states which are acutely conscious in a benign sort of way of how good their territories are and fear that strangers from outside are going to mess up what is an extremely nice life.
James, you know, should migrants have a choice in that sense about where they go once they're within, you know, the European arena? You know, we've said that they need to be, you know, relocated, given places to stay. But should they be able to pick? Because, you know, in fact, this small number that's gone to Luxembourg, I understand that actually recruiting even this number took some time. A large number of them didn't want to go to Luxembourg. They didn't feel that that was the right place for them. They wanted to go to Germany. Mm-hmm. When I was in Spain earlier this year, I was talking to city officials in Bilbao, and they were preparing for the arrival of what they presumed would be 1,000 or 2,000 people relocated to their city in the coming weeks, because they'd seen these headline numbers. Mm-hmm. As far as I understand, from looking at these numbers, none of that relocation has happened. So there are all these cities, you know, maybe because people don't want to learn Basque or don't want to be, you know, moved to the peripheries of Europe. Should people have that right? Because in fact, you know, if you live in Bilbao, you can have a good life. You should people be just told where they go?
I'm quite sure that if it's very difficult because one doesn't want to sound heartless, but if these people are as desperate as they sound and are eager to avoid and escape from what are no doubt desperate circumstances, what the hell's wrong with living in Bilbao? I mean, you would think that that would be a pretty nice place to live, or Luxembourg, quite frankly. I don't think many people would have too much of an issue living there. There is, of course, a language barrier, but you know, if these people can speak German, then that's one thing. But it is a challenge, you know, to what extent should these people have a carte blanche decision about where they'd like to relocate to? I'm sure there's places I'd like to go and live, quite frankly, but, you know, I can't just pick up tomorrow and say I'm going to turn up in Washington, D.C. and say, right, I've got to claim a right to abode here, quite frankly. I'd also like to take issue with this idea that just because places have got wide open spaces, that it's free to relocate to. I mean, crying out loud, I'm in Scotland. There's no one living in Scotland. It's wide open. It's just the Highlands.
We could move Scottish up, listeners.
Move them up onto the Highlands. But these places, these places are empty because no one wants to live in those parts of the country. You know, I mean, Canada is huge. I mean, it's like, you know, but a wild, you know, wilderness. But, you know, you can't relocate people to the wild, terrains of Canada or the desert terrains of the Sinai. I mean, if you move people to these countries that which are being identified, people are going to want to live in the urban areas, and they're going to be just as overflowing as anywhere else, quite frankly. So I think the idea that just because a country is large, that it can take more people, I think, is a slight problematic statement.
And there is a catch there, isn't there? I guess, Kathleen, because, you know, if you move people to, you know, if they go to Sweden, you move them, you know, to the far north of the country. Yes, you kind of share the, you know, the tax burden and the integration issue. But in a way, we know migrant stories in the past have been more successful, actually. You don't want people to live in ghettos, but actually when people live in communities, they have then networks of support, they integrate in their own pace. And we've seen that in London with communities, you know, Jewish, Bangladeshi, Italian, Pakistani. People start off in an area, they have those networks in their schools and their family connections, and then they get other connections and they begin to move out into wider society. So do you think we should be trying to disperse these people, or should we just be saying to Germany, look, you have all these people, they want to be there, they're going to work harder in Germany, you open the doors, you need to deal with them.
And that will certainly destroy Merkel and her government. Mm-hmm. Because the difficulty is, amongst many other difficulties, I take your point about networks of support in ethnic communities, but networks and support in ethnic communities take generations to integrate. And a real problem in terms of the adverse reaction are the claims that people who go to countries don't integrate. They don't want to. They want to stay in their own communities because it's safe and supporting. So that's very much a mixed point, I think.
Well, we're going to head to the US now. On Sunday, representatives of most of the Republican presidential campaigns met in Washington to discuss how to change the televised election debates. Together, they drafted a letter of demands to the networks. The list included opening and closing statements of at least 30 seconds, parity and integrity on questions, meaning that all candidates would receive roughly the same amount of questions, and approval of any graphics aired during the debates. It probably all seemed a good idea at the time. However, it soon became clear that not all of the candidates wanted to sign the letter. As a matter of fact, 6 out of the 14 candidates have already refused to put their names to it. So what's going on here? Kathleen, you know this world well. Were they right to try and start intervening in the televised debates? Have they been unfair so far? You know, do we need a new set of rules here?
Well, we could have a rule against not asking questions about fantasy football as a start. I mean, they're not debates. It's a misnomer. It's a series of interviews, one might say, in which you get 30 to 60 seconds to end. It was a real shooting in the collective foot, because it says, look, we're really scared. If you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to come across as looking like idiots. That's one reason, I think. Well, that's what made has made Christie and Kasich and so forth look strong and capable, because they weren't scurrying around saying, if you have the wrong graphics, I'm not going to play anymore. It was a dumb thing to do. And it's as though somehow saying that the temperature must be 67 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, who cares? Why does it matter? The days when they had to watch Nixon sweating at the debates, I think, have long passed.
James, dumbness, or do you think they have a point here?
Well, it's difficult because, of course, the Democrats and Barack Obama in particular have made great hay out of this. And the president overnight was mocking the GOP candidates, basically saying how can they be expected to deal with the leadership in Russia and China if they can't handle the debate moderators from MSNBC, which is a valid point. I think it's important to recognize that one of the problems you have here is that the way that these so-called debates are set up is that they are no such thing. I mean, they are a series of opportunities to present potted answers. There is either no or limited interaction between the various candidates at any one point. One of the challenges this year, of course, is that there are so many Republicans running for the nomination, some 17 at one point, that they don't even have enough stage space to get them all to one stage. So they're actually having the main event and then an underlying event with people who aren't even getting 1% in some cases. So the amount of time that people are getting to respond has been reduced to the absolute minimum. It's also problematic in as much as because of the limelight that the likes of Donald Trump are getting, for example, that they are getting a disproportionate amount of time. And this is leading to other candidates, quite rightly to an extent, saying, well, hang about a second, I am a candidate here. I'd like some time, please. But it does lead to a sort of a pettiness. And one of the reasons that they're trying to get these events shortened is because they are having to stand for, I think there was one event that lasted for some 3 hours, which is quite a long time to be standing on your feet, especially when you're not getting asked any questions. So I think there are fundamental flaws with how the debate process has been scheduled this year. And certainly the leadership of the GOP are taking great hits for this. It's difficult to understand how you're going to get around that, however, when you've got so many candidates, all of whom want equal time, which just frankly doesn't seem possible or viable in this the environment that which they're being set up in.
Kathleen, we've seen in many countries, as these debates get nearer, there is some kind of, you know, sweating by the politicians about whether it's a good idea. We saw it here in the UK. The current Prime Minister, David Cameron, was very unsure about whether he wanted to enter the process at all. And in a way did, you know, not at the last minute, but was able to kind of negotiate how those events were staged and what they would look like and how he would appear, etc., etc. But do you think in the end they're still important in getting over who candidates are, more than being on the stump, more than being on the campaign trail? Are they still moments when the American public decides who they want to be their president?
Well, I think so. I think politics in the U.S. is wholesale. It's a huge country. There's hundreds of millions of people, and you can't reach out to them as it happened in the old time. Therefore, you have to have television because it's the only medium through which they can all be seen. But what we're going to see, I mean, they are beauty contests, but they're beauty contests. This is the first round, this is the second round, and candidates drop out. And there's a whole year. And I think within about 6 months, when we have a much greater idea who the candidates are likely to be, there may actually be debates. You can't really argue with what's happening in that sense. Of course, they're going to try to control. Anyone would like to appear in the way that makes him or her look attractive, competent, authoritative, and presidential. But there's nothing much that can be done. It's just the journalists have to hold up because the candidates are going to continue to push. And it's a merry-go-round that happens at every election.
James, before we move on, one question. Are we seeing here a kind of appetite for failure, though? Because when I watch these debates, we're not looking for people to kind of, you know, land a great policy, to explain a great point. We always seem to be waiting for someone to say the wrong thing. We're waiting for that moment. So when you come off when they come off air, it's always like, okay, Jeb Bush didn't kind of land a punch. Are these negative in their very kind of origin?
Yeah, because what we've seen in the past is the fact that we have had presidential elections which have turned to some extent upon how the performances have occurred. I mean, you go back to 1960 with Kennedy and Nixon and the idea that people who watched the debate believed that Kennedy had won, those who listened to it believed that that Nixon had won. Gerald Ford famously declared that there was no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, which was a massive blow for his campaign. In 1992, George Bush was famously caught looking at his watch during the debate. You know, Barack Obama was seen to stumble very heavily during his first debate with Mitt Romney, which really knocked the wind out of his sails. So these are beauty contests, as Kathy rightly points out, but they have the ability to really turn the election for the negative, if not necessarily for the positive.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. Listen to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and James Boyes. Coming up next, the presidents of Taiwan and China are to meet for the first time in almost 70 years. Stay tuned.
The Monaco Minute is our daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinions and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special weekend edition, which brings you the best in hospitality, retail, food and drink, and culture. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time in London is 18:20, and my guests today are Kathleen Burke and James Boyes, regular voices here on Midori House. Now let's continue to Asia next. It was today announced that the presidents of China and Taiwan will meet in Singapore on Saturday. This will be the first meeting of leaders from the two rivals since the Chinese Civil War ended in 1949. Not much is known about what the discussions will include. However, what is known is that the presidents of China and Taiwan will address each other as Mr. rather than their usual titles, and will have dinner together after the meeting. The meeting is already under fire, however, from opposition politicians in Taipei, who say it is a blatant attempt by Beijing to influence the island's forthcoming presidential and legislative elections. James, how significant is this meeting? We know that this is on Taiwan's part, this is a candidate who is, you know, sympathetic to Beijing, mm-hmm. and there is a candidate waiting in the wings who's doing very well in the opinion poll, who could win, who is a proper independent person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's an important meeting. As you rightly point out, this is the first time that we've had a meeting of the leadership since the end of the Chinese Civil War. So this has a historic element to it. As we rightly point out, we have got forthcoming elections coming up, and we have an opposition party who make it very, very clear that there is an extent to which they would like to push for a complete break from the Chinese mainland. That, of course, is saber-rattling of the most dangerous kind as far as Beijing is concerned. So it's no surprise, I think, that the leadership are very, very happy to try and court and maintain good relationships with the incumbent party at this point. And one can understand why it is that the opposition party are seeing this as an incursion effectively upon what they would see as a domestic election. But of course, you know, from a national interest point of view, it's understandable why the Chinese leadership is trying to do this in an attempt to try to foster better, closer relationships, so that in the hope that, you know, if the incumbent maintains the office after the election, that there is an opportunity for closer working ties between the two leaders.
Kathleen, this is such a weird state of affairs. You know, obviously, China believes that Taiwan should be returned to the fold at some point, become part of Greater China. Taiwanese people don't seem any too keen on that, although their degrees of bellicosity, you know, vary depending on their political stance. But when he meets the two presidents, in a way, there's a kind of always this elephant in the room, isn't there?
Now, which particular elephant are you speaking about? The United States?
No, there's the United States elephant, but there's also they just cannot talk about what the real outcome of what Xi Jinping would like. He would like Taiwan to be part of his country.
Yes, indeed. I don't think that's going to happen in a long time, because unless there's a real political and indeed cultural change in Taiwan, which is a democracy, which is a live, bright economy, which has links, good trading links with an awful lot of countries, and of course 40% of their trade links are with China, which is a moderating influence on everything. There's no obvious advantage to China to go and bring Taiwan back. It's a good window to the outside world. And the problem is, of course, Taiwan and the United States have an alliance. And if China made military incursions, that would bring in the United States. And that no one, including China, wants to happen. It wants to edge the United States out. It doesn't want to do anything that will ground the United States even more than it has been doing with its attempts to take over the South China Seas. That is to say, China's attempts to make it clear in everyone's mind that it's called the South China Seas because it belongs to China. So Taiwan, in a funny sort of way, is important, but certainly not an overwhelming importance in geopolitical terms.
James, do you think that Taiwan has become one of these many dominoes in this this Pacific game that we're seeing played out?
I think it's long been a domino, quite frankly, and I think it's important to recognise, however, that the United States is no more interested in getting involved in a military conflict with China over Taiwan than it does in getting involved in a military scuffle with Russia over, I don't know, take your pick, Georgia, Ukraine, or anywhere, quite frankly. I think that what you're seeing is a very astute move by the Chinese to try to take advantage of what is an American attempt to sort of try and remain a stable player in the world and not get involved in saber rattling. I would think that, you know, trying to take a long view with regard to this, I think you are seeing moves towards, tepid moves, it must be said, towards some sort of democracy within China. And hopefully one can see within a series of decades, you know, the eventual end to Communist Party rule in that part of the world. And maybe at that point you could see moves towards a rapprochement between between the two lands. And I think that's perhaps the long-term view, which Washington might well be looking for a peaceful solution to this dilemma.
Catherine, you're shaking your head there. You don't think there will ever be a peaceful rapprochement, or you don't think that communism will have come to the end?
Well, yes to that, and plus several other questions. I mean, I have a strong belief that what you have to do in international relations is to manage events. You very seldom have such clean outcomes. End of communism, full stop. Therefore, you know, happiness between what might say greater China and Taiwan. No, I don't think the Chinese Communist Party is going to go out of power at any time in our lifetime and probably several lifetimes behind us. There's no obvious reason why it should. It has. It's not that it has complete control. It's that it's showing flexibility to be able to absorb shocks. And so I think this is, and its wealth and its now its position around the world is such that I think that it's with us for quite a long time. And I also think that Taiwan is going to stay independent for quite a long time. Well, functionally independent, if not judicially independent.
Well, we have time just to sneak in one final story, which is back in the US. Jeb Bush, the Republican candidate, has apologized to the French for making a joke about their work ethic. Just last week, Bush criticized the Florida Senator Marc Rubio for missing votes in Congress, saying that the Senate operates a French work week. Ooh. Now, James, he has apologised. Is that an insult to work a French work week? You know, the French officially have a 30-hour work week, although many, many people there work much longer than that. But is it an insult to work 35 hours a week?
It's funny, isn't it? The French must get tired of being the whipping boys in American politics, especially on the right. And if you remember, not that long ago, John Kerry was being criticised for not only looking French, but being able to speak French, as though that was some sort of block upon being the president. I think what's interesting here is the fact that Jeb Bush has decided to walk that back. I don't think he's going to get any great sympathy from the Republican Party for apologising to the French. It seems that if you want to win the Republican vote, you actually make sure that you actually criticise the French as much as possible. So it's interesting also that he was taking on his former protégé, Marco Rubio, who of course has really come through. We were talking about the debates earlier on. If you want to talk about someone who's been making great hay and been seen to do very well out of those debates, I'd suggest it's Marco Rubio, who I think is well placed at this point to benefit most from what many people see as the eventual demise of the sort of very ego-driven Donald Trump bandwagon.
Catherine, we only have about 45 seconds left, but is it, you know, many Americans, I'm sure, would like to work 35 hours a week. Yeah, again, is it an insult to the French, really, or should America be looking to what France is doing?
Well, America's never going to look to what France is doing.
You heard it here first, but not really.
Not for the reasons that John has said, of course, but because Americans only take 2 weeks of holiday a year normally. So I think the whole work ethic, which celebrates America, which America celebrates, it would be very difficult for them to give up.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we've put in our full stint as well. A 30-minute work hour for us. Kathleen Burke and James Boyce, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all we have time for. Today's show, well, it was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Jamie Waters. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, Gaia Lutz will be keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's the Entrepreneurs Show with Daniel Giacopelli. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller, where you can catch up on more of the day's news and get some analysis too. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is of course 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening and have a great evening. Bye-bye.